Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and today I'm joined by Scott Lemieux and Eric Loomis. Together, we have the great pleasure of interviewing Stephen Duesner, author of Where the Devil Don't Stay, a new history of the drive-by truckers, or DBTs, as they are more commonly known today. How is everybody doing?
Great.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Well, Stephen, once again, thank you for joining us. I'm going to open this conversation by sort of lobbing forth, the basic fundamental question that animates the book. What drew you to the DBTs, and what interested you in terms of thinking that they were really a book-worthy band and sort of drove you to put this book together?
Well, first and foremost, I kind of grew up in the area that they're from, not North Alabama, but West Tennessee, just about an hour from Muscle Shoals and Florence, where the band is from. And, I moved out of that area. And when I did, almost immediately, I discovered the band, and I heard them singing about these places that I recognized, and I developed a really deeply personal connection to their music. And I think what's remarkable is I don't think I'm alone in that. I think a lot of fans and a lot of people have a similar relationship with them, and so it was really amazing to be away from home and to hear somebody singing about home that way. But then the more I delved into their music and the more I heard and the more they released, I realized that they were doing something very interesting, which was sort of interrogating certain Southern pieties, certain icons and symbols and things like that, and really challenging a lot of the way the South is perceived. And I really wanted to explore that because that helped me with my own reckoning about coming from the South and about coming from a place that I dearly loved, yet had this very ugly history and had parts of a culture that were, that I did not agree with. And so for me, it was a very powerful thing to listen to this band and then to start writing about this band, for that connection to home, but also just for how I thought of myself.
Just to follow up a second there, how did it come together? Did you propose this to the press, or did you work with the band to sort of have this conversation, or how did the sausage get made?
Well, I David Menconi, who was the editor for this American Music series at University of Texas, he and I had discussed the idea of this book probably in about 2014 or 15. And when I was in 2016, my wife and I moved to England temporarily. And we lived in this really crazy cottage on the edge of the University of Birmingham. And she was teaching and researching, and I was kind of left to my own devices. The nearest, like, real coffee shop was about, a mile away. So every day I would walk this mile and back and listen to the drive-by truckers, and to be so far removed from home and then to have this kind of third person distant perspective on the South and on America. It really kind of made me realize how much they're talking about place in their songs. And it really brought that to the forefront, to be somewhere completely new and foreign to me. And so I think that's how it came together in terms of the idea for this, to sort of examine the band through their depictions of place. And after that, I pitched David on the book, and he liked it. We kind of made some adjustments, and I got the contract pretty quickly after that. So, but that was 2016. So right as all hell broke loose politically, I get the go ahead to write this book. So.
Yeah. This question may have a little bit of a long run up to it, but I find it interesting that you have these guys who are just sort of, kind of ne'er-do-wells in their 20s, right? They're really struggling to make it. I mentioned it before the podcast, Patterson Hood and Cooley and as their Denver Twins version on Sunday. And, you know, right before playing Liv and Bubba, you know, Hood, it talks about how nothing good in his life happened before he turned 30 and moved to Athens, right? So you have these guys that are, you know, struggling, and, you know, Hood grows up in this, the world of the Shoals, and his father's part of the house band and fame and all of this stuff. And so his background is a little different than a lot of white Southerners, but right, you have this really long kind of trajectory, beginning with these early albums, moving into the rock opera. And, you know, these are songs some of which are political, but are not necessarily, as a general rule, that political of a band, right? And yet, over time, that not only expands into being a full-fledged protest band in the last few albums, but also, you know, Patterson Hood is kind of in his 50s, has sort of become like the voice of the progressive white South. Right, to the point that he's writing this op-ed in the New York Times denouncing the Confederate flag. And to me, this is kind of a remarkable journey here. And so I guess I my question, such as it is to ask you, how do you think that this band and this individual in this band becomes this almost iconic voice for a white progressive South in this time and place?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that you're right in the songs he's writing then are not explicitly political, but I think they have a political edge to them. He's talking about income inequality. He's talking about the lengths people will go to, you know, to get by. And I think, you know, with the tragedy of Adam's house cat that never went anywhere, no matter how much they put into it. I think he kind of understands that in a way that maybe he even at the time didn't realize. And so I think that gives him a good foundation so that when they do shift into a more explicit political songwriting, it's not just coming out of nowhere. It's kind of, it's kind of been leading up to it. I feel like there's, you know, it's in the book, I talk about the duality of the Southern thing, that term he coined. And I think that, you know, with American Band in 2016, he's really expanding that to the duality of the American thing. And it's a very similar mix of pride and shame. Like you're proud to be American, but you're also recognize that there's some bad aspects of all of this. And I think that a lot of that is rooted in that early songwriting that he did. So you're right that he does become this voice of kind of the white progressive male, not just the Southern male, but I would say the white progressive male in general. But yeah, I think a lot of it is coming from the South and realizing that you can't just feel one way about it. You have to feel a lot of different ways. It has to be a very complex relationship to your home. And so that when he does make that leap, he's kind of got that nuance built in already. So it's not just coming out of nowhere. And it's not a very, it doesn't feel like it's just kind of paying lip service to an idea or something like that. It feels like he's lived it or he embodies it in a way. So.
And one interesting thing is it's not just Patterson either, that in addition to the, you know, the kind of early kind of latent political songs like Sinkhole and Putting People on the Moon, I think of Cooley's Uncle Frank, which is my favorite song in the first two albums. So I don't think that's I think it's a minority opinion. And of course, Jason's The Day John Henry Died. You know, I definitely do think you see, you know, all of that, you know, that they really were a band that wrote more about class than almost anybody else, even before the kind of more, you know, the really explicitly political turn of American Band. Which
Living Bubba is a really political song.
Yeah,
right.
That's, I mean, true,
especially
too.
At the time they're recording.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm also, you know, I'm curious, and I think Eric will want to talk more about American Band as well. But there's a perception, you know, kind of throughout the book, and I'm not quibbling with your judgment, but even from inside the band, that English Oceans was kind of a bit of a lull and a low point, which I find very curious, since I think it's a wonderful record. I was just wondering what kind of, you know, drove that idea that it was a rut. And I know one unusual thing about it is that it's probably the most Cooley dominated of the regular records. So I don't know if that's primarily maybe sort of Patterson, kind of being in a point of confusion. But, you know, I was just curious as a theme of your book, because I would have never, you know, I've always considered English Oceans actually where they really, you know, sort of got back to their first rate work. So I was interested in why the, there was kind of that perception doesn't seem to be shared within the band.
Yeah, I mean, he even told me that he thought with that album that they had, that hit a point where maybe people were getting tired of them, or maybe that the story wasn't compelling that they were telling as a band wasn't compelling anymore, that people just weren't paying attention as much. And I don't think that's wrong. I mean, I remember when I got that out of duty, and I just kind of was like not terribly excited about that album. And I do realize that they had just gone through this seismic lineup change with, both John Neff and Shauna Tucker leaving the band. And I could go on and on about why I think Shauna leaving the band is one of the biggest shakeups in their history, because she's got a way of playing that allows them to explore all of this, you know, amazing Muscle Shoals sound and history. And so I don't know. I always felt like that was more of a transition album, because you can hear the seeds of some of Cooley's political songwriting in the title track, you know, where he's talking about these kind of grievances of angry youth, and the sort of tall tales they tell themselves to justify it. So, but yeah, I mean, I do think that there was a sense that maybe they needed to regroup, or at least that's what Patterson is telling me. But you're right though, that Cooley does dominate that album. I mean, Shit Shot Counts and the title track, I think, are two great ones by him. So,
and I'm glad, by the way, that you do write a lot about Shauna's bass playing, which I think often doesn't get enough credit, but is really like some of those grooves, like Used to Be a Cop, and you know that is something that I understand why it had to happen, but I do think that they do, you know, the rhythm section is not quite the same without her, and I'm glad you emphasized that.
Yeah, and that's nothing against Matt Patton, who's the new bass player and who is fantastic. But Shauna just had she was just a really great presence in that band as a bass player who you know, like you said, used to be a cop. To me, that sounds like Chic. That sounds like La Freak or something like that, you know. But also as a singer, I mean, she's kind of pulling them in these interesting directions that I think are very embedded in the music and the history of the Muscle Shoals region. And so I feel like her departure was pretty major.
So I want to sort of turn back time a little bit. You talk, I think we were all fans of the Drive-By Truckers during the sort of the Dirty South and Decoration Day phase, and then came A Blessing and a Curse. You talk about A Blessing and a Curse, but could you talk to us a little bit more? And I don't want to go ahead and say something like what went wrong during A Blessing and a Curse, but I don't know how else to like make, but you know, re-listening to the album, yeah, it has one of the strongest three song blocks in the entire catalog, right? If you, you start with Cooley's and then Isbell's and then Hood's and then a lot of not good songs. I mean, what happened with this album? What was happening with the band when this album was being put together?
I mean, a lot is happening with the band at this time. I mean, you know, Jason Isbell, who's this kid they pick up, literally right after they release Southern Rock Opera and becomes this like almost instant star in the band. He is, you know, he's young. He's a different generation from them. So they've paid their dues, and he's just kind of thrown into the middle of this. And so he had been doing a lot of drugs and drinking a lot leading up to that album. And, you know, it had just gotten out of control and it was creating a lot of conflict within the band, but more crucially, it was creating a lot of conflict with Shauna Tucker, who was at the time his wife. And, you know, he's pretty frank about his behavior at this time. And he was pretty much doing whatever he could to alienate everybody in this band. And I think at one point he said he pissed Cooley off, and he just basically said, "You don't piss Cooley off." Like, that's the last straw. And I think that it was one of those things where it was, they were close to breaking up, and everybody was kind of frazzled at that point. And so that's when they make this album. And they go in and they're pulling some old songs, they're writing some new songs, but nothing has been kind of road tested. Like, previous to this, they've been touring one album, recording the next album, and writing the one after that. So they've had this incredible period of being very prolific. And so then they kind of go in and they don't have like a real clear path for this album. And so it's kind of just like coming together more in the studio. And I don't know. I remember I was driving around Birmingham with Patterson. We had just done this interview over lunch, and I was taking him to this venue, and we got lost. And he was telling me about that album and how he thinks it's their least good one. He thinks that's the one that where they were at their worst. And he'll put it up against the worst albums by other bands, and he thinks it fares pretty well. But he did say that's one though that has been resurrected by fans a little bit, like kind of reassessed, and it's the favorite of a lot of people who love the band. I don't get that. I agree with Patterson. I think it's the last one I go to. So
I guess to kind of follow up on that, I mean at one level every band puts out a bad album, right? How many bad Stones albums are there? There's a lot of bad Stones albums, right? How many bad Who albums are there? There's a lot of bad Who albums.
All of them.
So, you know, I guess the kind of almost existential crisis this album causes among Truckers fans is, to me, a little overwrought because, okay, it's not a successful album, right? I do think, though, the problem with that album was more the production than the songwriting. Like, I think most of the songs hold up pretty well. And when they play them live, I saw before the pandemic, Hood pulled out Wednesday, you know, in a live show. It's a great song, you know?
Yeah.
But there was, a pretty heavy concern among a lot of us after Blessing and a Curse came out of like, okay, where is this band going, right? And then is Believes. And then Brighter Than Creation Star comes out. And to me, this is just an astoundingly great album. I think it holds up. My favorite is hard to say, it depends on the day, but it has a legitimate claim in my view to be the best Truckers album. There's a little bit of filler maybe, but there's 19 songs on the album. Of course there's going to be a little bit. I mean, it's a huge sprawling piece of work, and almost every song is between great and total gold. And so I'm wondering if you could, since we are talking about A Blessing and a Curse, if we could talk a little bit about the rebirth of the band with Brighter Than Creation Stark and the kind of how that sort of sprung them into the 2010s.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that is probably one of the most crucial albums in their career in that. Yeah. I mean, it took what it had been to date, their sort of least essential album, and kind of rebounded in this amazing way. And I love that album. I love that it's so long. I love that it's 19 tracks, because every time I listen to it, I feel like I have a new favorite. Like, there's always something new to discover in there. It's really fun album to dig into that way. And I was just looking over the book again and seeing that I had written almost a page on the home front, and I might be the only person who writes that much on the home front ever. And it's a great song. It's just not one that gets written about a lot. But to get back to your question, you know, during that period, they are, you know, if you go back and listen to some of the bootlegs that are out from that period right after Jason leaves, you can kind of tell they're trying to figure things out. And they're trying to, like, they're not quite sure where they're going. And I think that they kind of figured that out on the road. And I think that they figured out that out simply by just keeping going. You know, a lot of the songs are from, you know, written during that period, written before Jason left the band. But it does kind of feel like they avoided something pretty catastrophic there. And I do think it's interesting too. Like when Jason leaves the band, they make one of their best records. When Shauna leaves the band, they make kind of this record that is very tentative, you know, English Ocean. So I always think of those two, I was in my head as kind of linked as these departure albums.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking back here. I saw, you know, I think one of the ways in which they did put it back together was that Dirt Underneath tour, which was an all acoustic tour, which I think was the first time they'd ever done something like that. I don't know, but you know, that set list still exists. And that in the show I saw, which was the Santa Fe show, and flipping through it, you know, they played After the Scene Dies. They, you know, which I think is a great song as well. They get, they debuted Two Daughters and a Beautiful Life, which, you know, is this very powerful song. A bunch of the songs off of that album end up being played, you know, kind of road tested on this acoustic tour. Daddy Needs a Drink is another one that gets played in that show. And so I guess I kind of saw that process as it was going. But I just continue to be amazed about what a great album that is. But anyways, Scott, I guess it's your turn.
Yeah, and that's what I think, you know, one key thing to Brighter Than Creation's Dark is, you know, those coolly kind of almost, you know, country gold songs like Lisa's Birthday that, you know, he hadn't really, you know, real contrast to the kind of arena rock of A Blessing and a Curse. So I think that's a really major part of it, which I think is interesting. One, you know, since we've kind of already talked a lot about Blessing Curse, I was curious, you know, one thing occurred to me during your first answer, you know, about, you know, kind of writing and researching this book, which is that, you know, obviously Patterson and Cooley are very different people. You know, Patterson is sort of very active on social media, very garrulous, you know, like, you know, has, you know, very public, you know, whereas, you know, Cooley is extremely offline, you know, and throughout this book, you know, both, you know, like basically, you know, that the end of a lot of people in the band, including Isbell and Earl Hicks, was getting on Cooley's bad side. And you know, I was just, you know, I was curious about what it was like, you know, because you obviously, you know, had some interviews with Cooley, which are some of the best parts of the book. But I was wondering what it was like, you know, working with Cooley, and if that was, you know, if there were any, and not that, you know, he doesn't come off, he's not in any way like a mean or unbullet, but just, you know, just a very, you know, sort of very quiet and kind of intimidating presence. I was wondering what it was like, working with him and interviewing him during the process of the book.
Yeah, so it's really funny. My mother lives in Hoover, Alabama, and he apparently lived about a mile away from her. And so I saw him one day just jogging in front of her house, which was totally weird and surreal. But, you know, before I started the book, I had interviewed both Jason and Patterson before. But I had never talked to Mike. Mike, it feels weird to call him Mike. I mean, he's just Cooley. I feel like everybody, his dog calls him Cooley. So I was really intimidated. And it was over at his house. And I just, you know, it was too hot because it was the middle of summer to drive over, to walk over there. So I had to drive just like short distance to see him. And I was super intimidated. But I was intimidated because, like, you know, I don't even know how it's going to go, just even talking with him, if he's going to give me any kind of answer, or if it's going to be like talking to Jay Maskus, where he gives you a one word answer after about a minute silence, you know. But no, he was great. He was, you know, Patterson has a memory for all of this, and he's got it all in his head, and I hope he writes the book he's been talking about, because I think it'll be incredible. But Cooley has such a good grasp of how everything works in the band. He can tell you what they were doing with Southern rock opera and why it was important to do it a certain way. He can tell you, why it was important to write Raymond Cassiano a certain way. Like, he knows how all of this works and everything fits together, but he can also get off track. Cause I mean, I think we spent about an hour talking about, like, Dominionist politics and like why it was wrong for this Christian academy near his home to have their own police force. Like, you know, he's somebody who pays a lot of attention and you know, is obviously a very good storyteller. But you know, he's kind of a fun guy to talk to because you just, I mean, he's such a great voice, and I loved working with that material from him because it's so rich and it's so funny. And it made me a little bit like, I wish I could write like that. I wish I could write a line like I, you know, comparing Skynyrd fans to Christians or something like that. Like that's, you know, I'm really lucky to get that kind of material from somebody for my first book. It's just, it's, but even Patterson is the same way. Jason's the same way. You know, just a lot of great, rich voices to work with. And that to me as a writer is a lot of fun.
Since this is actually going to be one of my questions, can you talk about that? Because I happened to pull up the great quote about Skynyrd and Jesus, and it kind of got a lot of attention on Twitter. But you know, because I think it's not only a great line, but I think it says a lot about kind of the, you know, sort of the band's music and its complicated relationship to kind of other Southern bands. So I thought I'd give you an invitation to tell that to sort of.
Well, I should have marked it in the book so that I could read it. But yeah, he just says like something to the effect that he looks at Skynyrd fans like Christians. Skynyrd's a lot like Jesus. He likes a lot of the work, but he hates the fans. And I mean, that's so perfectly put. And I kind of put that in there and I realized like, you know, I'd probably need to take a page out because he just summed up what I just tried to say in a page. But, you know, that was one of the interesting things about writing this book was like exploring not just Lynyrd Skynyrd, but their relationship with Lynyrd Skynyrd and how that has been really twisted recently, especially, you know, since the reunion in 87, it's like all the nuance that Ronnie Van Zant was putting into his songs has been whitewashed. And so he's saying one thing very clearly in his songs, and apparently nobody cares to get that or cares to look into that. Like I kind of had an idea of that, but I didn't quite realize the degree to which I would become a huge Skynyrd fan during the process of this book.
That's, you know, it's really interesting that you say that because this book inspired me to go back and, you know, sort of take a look at the entire Skynyrd, the entire Skynyrd catalog with Ronnie Van Zant. And I was just taken by how careful of a lyricist, Van Zant was, right. And just how good he was at turning a phrase here and there, and giving it a lot of ambiguity or clarity when you didn't expect it. So I find that's very interesting. And it's interesting sort of to reread Skynyrd in the light of DBT. That seemed very, very productive. So my question, and this has to goes back to the writing book, and you've alluded to a little bit of here, and you talk about it in the book. So, I mean, you are sort of approach Drive-By Truckers as a family, right? Even the members who are no longer with them, like it's sort of like a big family, right? How was it sort of talking to all of these people who were with the band, who may have left the band and not really happy circumstances, but with one sort of notable exception, remain friends with the band, remain in the band's orbit. You know, I'm not going to ask you to tell any tales out of school or anything like that, right? But, you know, what about this was particularly fun or interesting, being able to talk with Jason and Shauna and Rob and all these other folks who've been with the band and then transitioned out, but are still close with these people?
I mean, I think that sums a lot of it up. I mean, they are a family. They've changed over time. The lineup has changed so much over time. And so they've been, I think of this rolling blob that kind of picks up a member and then shoots it off as they bounce along. And, you know, even at the beginning that they didn't intend this band to be a traditional band in that they didn't intend it to have any kind of set lineup. It was just, you know, whoever could show up that night. And I think that kind of spirit carries through in a lot of ways. And you can kind of see that in the way that people talk about the band. And the way that people talk about Patterson in particular, like, there are some hurt feelings from a couple of people, but in general, like, everybody just, I mean, they have a very good relationship still with everybody who's left the band. And some of those that weren't so good are being repaired now. I think that says a lot. I mean, I know that Patterson and Cooley kind of became the central figures in the book. I mean, that was not by design. It was more just like, that's where the material led for these two people to be the focal points. But yeah, they do seem like the parents in this large family. I don't know. It's been interesting to see too, that, you know, they're playing shows with Jason again. They're releasing that, that excellent Plan 9 triple live album from, 2006, you know, that they're still sort of connected to these people after so long.
So I guess, since, you know, a bit ago, we were talking about some of, you know, like, the problematic nature of Skynyrd. Maybe we should talk about the name of the band itself, right? I mean, Hood, you know, Hood has a tendency for bad band names. I mean, there's this short-lived band, Horse Pussy, maybe the worst name of a band that has ever been given. You know, and Drive-By Truckers, you know, I always thought of it as just kind of a dumb band name. I mean, I get that it has a particular meaning, right? But it's become more controversial in recent years, and, you know, Hood expressing some regret about maybe the name of the band, although not changing the name of the band. And I never really got the sense he needed to change the name of the band. I mean, unlike, say, the Dixie Chicks, I don't really see Drive-By Truckers as building on questionable race relations, but other people do feel differently about that. And so I'm wondering if you talk about the name and how it sort of resonates today in a community that is politically different than it was 20 years ago or more now, when the band's name was coined.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll start by saying that whenever somebody has asked me about the subject of my book, especially a civilian who might not know who they are, and I've always had to couch it by saying, okay, it's about this band called the Drive-By Truckers. It's a terrible name, but, you know, it is a terrible name. I think everybody agrees that it's a terrible name. And I think some people say, oh, how much further they could have gotten if they had a better name. But I also think, look how far they got with a terrible name. I do think it's important to remember, you know, they came out of like the heyday of the alt country scene, which had a lot of questionable band names and a lot of kind of questionable rural humor. You know, there were a lot of bad puns in that scene. There were a lot of like really condescending, ironic gestures towards, you know, rural communities. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, it is combining two important aspects of the band, though. On one hand, you've got Truckers, which is like this kind of like working class blue collar figure. You know, even at the time, like, Trucker songs were big among all country fans. Like, you know, Sunvolt was covering like Red Sovine or Del Reeves or somebody like that a lot, you know. And then you've got Drive-By, which is obviously a reference to what is kind of perceived to be black on black violence, you know. And I think at the time he was trying to suggest that they were as influenced by country, by rap music, as by country music. They were trying to gesture that they were taking in more than just country music. I think now it looks a little like it's, they're appropriating something that they don't really have a claim to. And I really struggle with how to present this. And I'm not sure I did it very thoroughly, because I've been thinking a lot about it lately and thinking about how my idea of the South was expanded considerably writing this book, and realizing that the sort of South that I knew, experienced growing up, but also had read about in novels and histories and things like that, was very limited. And so I do think it's important that they are gesturing towards a larger South than just the one that they're depicting, that they are saying that there is something beyond just what the sort of white experience that they're writing in their songs. They never pretend to sing about Black Southern experience, but I do think it's important that they were trying to sort of acknowledge that something existed beyond this, something that influenced them, and not just in the subject matter, but in the approach to telling a story. So I think that's really important. I mean, it's, I don't think they need to change the name necessarily, but I do think it was important to at least acknowledge that these things have changed and these things have developed, and maybe they played a small role in shifting how we think about these things.
This is just to throw in a little bit here. I mean, this name is taken just immediately in the wake of Rick Rubin's sessions with Johnny Cash, where Rubin is really explicit in terms of, you know, drawing these connections between between rap and between Cash's work and between violence and how violence is portrayed in black and white music. And that has always seemed to me, you know, to be one of the influences that is feeding into the choice of this name, Drive-By Truckers, right? Is just how big Cash is in the mid 1990s and how his work is being reassessed.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that that was something that Rick Rubin had been sort of talking about at that time, but that's an interesting connection.
Yeah, and one thing that, you know, and you know, of course, your book, you know, has a lot of rich stuff about, you know, Southern culture and the great stories about the Bad Memories people. But it's also, you know, a book written by a great rock critic. And there's just a lot about music, and really, you know, and one interesting thing is that, especially because the Southern rock opera, you know, and you're trying to evangelize the band, despite their terrible name to people, you know, I think there's an assumption that they sound like the Allmans or Skinner, and they don't really sound like either, especially the former. But, you know, on the one hand, there's obviously a lot of punk and post-punk, which they, you know, and I know Isbell's talked about being exposed to that music on the tour bus, you know, and I always think of, I don't know if it's a Cooley solo on Darkened Flags, The Cust of Gone, but I've always thought of that as like the best Joey Santiago guitar work since Bossa Nova. Like there's, you know, that you can hear all that punk, you know, through that. And, you know, I think the name does acknowledge the influence of the incredible hip hop scene in the South at the time the band was forming as well. And that, you know, is, you know, you can, you know, you, it's definitely a part of their songwriting, you know, although that's, you know, not their music. And then the third influence, I thought, you know, I one of my favorite parts of the book was talking, you know, about, you know, how Patterson's life was literally saved by rock and roll, but also the influence that John Prine had on him during those really difficult days in Memphis. You know, and ironically, I saw the Drive-By Truckers and John Prine about a week apart in Albany. And it was the week I saw the Drive-By Truckers the day after McCain had voted to advance the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. So the day before he stopped it. So that was one of the most fiercely political, you know, they had this whole thing about the healthcare bill in putting people on the moon. It was just amazing. And actually Prine actually had more anti-Trump stuff in his, you know, you don't think it was being political, but he was actually, it is commentary was actually, you know, which is surprising, but it was kind of amazing to see that back. And you really saw, you know, and of course, I know they've covered Daddy's Little Pumpkin, but it was, you know, because they don't think of Prine and Patterson as really being that similar, but seeing them together, you could definitely see it. So it was really interesting in noting how central that is. So it's really incredible, actually, I think the diversity of musical influences. And I think that's one thing that's made the band so interesting, that they're not only great songwriters, but there's really an incredible musicality. And you got into that a bit with Shauna, but they're really, you know, thoughtful, you know, and despite the fact that they sound so casual and unrehearsed, that there really is, it's kind of amazing how much is going on there. And I think that's a really important part of your book, that you really try to bring that out.
Well, thank you, first of all. I appreciate that. And that's something I really wanted to underline was that, or underscore, was that, you know, they started out as this kind of alt country band, and they kind of added all these rock riffs to it. And they've been out so many different bands. I mean, and Cooley can still write a great country song. I mean, like Sarah's Flame no matter its subject, is a great country song. But I also kind of love the fact that they kind of file all of that, everything you just mentioned and so much more, under Southern rock. And so, you know, it's Southern rock not being just Skinner or the Almonds or whoever, but like, you know, it's Little Richard, it's pretty much everybody. And so anything can be
REM kind of, and Pylon and B-52s. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it can be whatever you want it to be. And it's just, I kind of love the fact that even as they were defining themselves as a Southern band, they were redefining what Southern rock meant to them, at least, that it could be something that's very broad and allows all these different sounds and styles. I think that is a large part of why we're still talking about them, is because there are very many bands all in one.
This concludes the first half of our conversation with Stephen Duesner, author of Where the Devil Don't Stay. Please come back next week for some more discussion of the place of the drive-by truckers within the American South. Also, some conversation about our least favorite drive-by truckers tracks, and a little bit about how the drive-by truckers affected the long-term career of Jason Isbell, one of the most famous members or former members of the band. Thank you. Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.